This is the Monday, September 26th, 2016 episode of The History Author Show. Visit our iHeartRadio channel or subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a brand new interview every Monday morning.
Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize, sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Karyanis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio. This week, our time machine spins us back to a favorite destination of mine, the Boer War, in the twilight of the 19th century and the eve of the bloody 20th. Once there, we'll see a familiar face, but it'll be much younger than we're used to, capped with a shock of fiery red hair that matches his ambition to slash a lasting mark on the world with a cavalry sword. The name Sir Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill today invokes the balding, cigar-chomping British bulldog who stared down Hitler across the English Channel, so it's easy to forget that he was a soldier once, and young. Distinguished author Candice Millard introduces us to this Churchill as he puts his foot on the first rung of that ladder to greatness. Her story begins in gold and diamond-rich southern Africa, an adventure that includes an armored train battle, capture, spending Winston's 25th birthday in a prisoner of war camp, and a flight to freedom so daring it would fail the suspension of disbelief test if this was fiction. Candice Millard's book is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. As you know, if you've heard my chat with Simon Reed, author of Winston Churchill Reporting, Adventures of a Young War Correspondent, this is my favorite period of Churchill's life, before he's the giant cast in bronze. In fact, if Churchill were a comic book character, we would call the Boer War his origin story. You can visit today's guest at CandiceMillard.com and follow her on Twitter at Candice_Millard. Her previous books are bestsellers The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, and Destiny of the Republic, A Tale of Madness, Medicine, and the Murder of a President. That one covers the assassination of President James A. Garfield, who you've heard Todd Arrington of the James A. Garfield National Historic Site describe on our very first show as the greatest president we never had. Okay, now that we've loaded our supplies and weapons onto the transport, let's set sail for the Cape of Good Hope, where we'll meet Candice Millard's Hero of the Empire. I'm joined on the line by New York Times best-selling author Candice Millard, who brings us Hero of the Empire. Thank you for making time to talk with the History Author Show.
Thank you for having me.
I love this Churchill. I feel like he's an old friend of mine, and was really glad that you turned your talents to telling of his adventures in this period of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote about them himself in my early life. And mm-hmm. when someone asked me what it was like reading Hero of the Empire, I said, it's like enjoying your favorite dish, your favorite cake, and it's baked by an excellent new chef. So as an author, I know you said that you find it daunting, but also it's exciting to write about Churchill. But how did you meet that unique challenge of serving up a tale in such a way that it appeals to people who are familiar with the story just as much as somebody who picks it up for the first time?
Well, I think that the thing that I bring to the story, I try to bring, is to do as much research as I possibly can. So obviously I read Churchill's own accounts and I read those accounts of the people who were also there at the time and who were around him. But I also try to just reach out even farther. So, for instance, you know, I happened to find a firsthand account of a British soldier who happened to be at Escort at the same time. And he doesn't even mention Churchill, but he talks about things that I wouldn't have known otherwise. just everything from the birds that were there, the trees that were around the camp, how they ate, how they bathed, all those little details. I spent a lot of time working at National Geographic, so I'm interested in a lot of different things, and so I spend more time than probably a normal, sane person would on things like, well, what was it like when he was in this coal mine shaft for nearly 3 days? So I sought out people who had worked for decades in coal mines in South Africa, and they told me exactly what it would have been like at that time, and things that I hadn't known, like that they were ponies down there and what it would have smelled like then for him. I was also very curious about the railroad system at that time in South Africa because, you know, he's captured on an armored train. He hides for a while on a train and on his way out of the country to freedom. So I found experts on that. I read about that. So I cast a very wide net and try to get as much information as I can. Some of it never makes it into the book, but it informs my understanding of the story and the event and the time. And I hope that comes across to the reader.
Speaking for myself, it really does because I have read about it before. Mm-hmm. So it would be easy to pick up this book and say, oh, okay, I've read sort of all of that before, frankly.
Right. Sure.
But I picked this up and you talked about the coal mine. And I said, here it's as if you're almost getting the director's cut, some of the details that you put in, because you're looking around. Like for me, I've thought of many times of Churchill just sitting there and he has the rats crawling on him in the coal mine and they steal his candle and all of that. And you looked around and told us some of the things like no idea, ponies living down there. Mm-hmm. Fascinating for me with an animal background, both them and the rats. And so that's a detail, or him with the smoking the cigar and getting startled. And that's a suspenseful moment, even though I know that he gets out. It's a suspenseful moment that he gets caught.
That's great.
He has run for election at this point and lost in 1899. Mm-hmm. So he needs a job. He's not independently wealthy. Many people just assume, I mean, he wasn't born. You said another soldier didn't write about him. There was no reason to write about him necessarily then, except maybe to complain about him. But
good point.
He was always keen for adventure. Thank you. And he turns to his pen. He could always make a living out of writing. Mm-hmm. And he says, I'm going to go cover the Boer War as a correspondent. You visited as part of this research today's South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you'd explain to us, looking back, the reason, for one thing, that they fought the war, but also how they view it today in the former free states, the Boer Republics, and Churchill in particular.
So the reason they went to war is sort of the oldest reason for war, and that's over wealth. The Boers were these very religious, very racist, very sort of stubbornly independent people who just wanted to be left alone. And they've been living in South Africa for centuries, and they wanted to get away from the British Empire. And that's what prompted the famous Great Trek, where in 1835, where they left the Cape, and they went hundreds of miles into the African interior and established their own republics. Unfortunately for them, gold and diamonds were found in the mid-1800s on their land, specifically the Transvaal, and that's where a lot of the fighting took place. And as soon as that happened, Paul Kruger, who had become president of the Transvaal and was president during the Boer War, said, this gold will cause our country to be soaked in blood. And that's exactly what happened. So just a few years later in 1880, the first Boer War broke out. And then almost 20 years later, the same issues are taking place. The British still want this land. The Boers still want their independence. It becomes more and more and more tense. Churchill himself is fanning the flames of war. And finally, the Boers issue an ultimatum and they say to the British, stand down or prepare for war. And this is exactly what the British wanted to happen. They wanted an excuse for war. And so the Boers had issued an ultimatum and the British just let it pass. And war begins. And when you go to South Africa, you can see the results of and the history of and the memory of this war everywhere you go. Everywhere there are battlefield markers, there are memorials, there are museums dedicated to the Boer War and the lives that were lost there. And you can see everything that happened to Winston Churchill. You can, and I did. I went to where he was captured. I went to this POW camp in Pretoria. I went to where that colliery was it's no longer there, but I went to exactly where that coal mine shaft was, where he hid. I went into what's now Mozambique and Portuguese East Africa to the consulate where he went when he finally became a free man, same building. So all that history is there. It's everywhere you look.
And it's something that we've forgotten about it outside because it is very bloody. I mean, you have the concentration camps used by that name here in the Boer War, also in Cuba where TR fights.
Right.
And it's a lot of suffering and it's worth remembering. And also that we get to see Churchill's grace here, don't we? You get to see his mercy once the enemy's defeated, which we know from World War II.
That's right. That was something. And I think that a lot of people don't understand that about him, or they've forgotten, or they never learned it, that during war, no one fought harder than Winston Churchill. And after war, no one was quicker or more eager to extend the hand of friendship and help someone who had just been his enemy rebuild. When we think of Winston Churchill, we think of him in World War II. We think of him as an older man sending young men into war. But the truth is that no one knew better, and very few people knew as well, the real cost and horrors of war.
On the cover, speaking of that point, Hero of the Empire features Winston Churchill in his uniform and his helmet. He's very spit polished there. I set the book down, as you saw on Twitter, and tweeted out a picture that I had it there at the Churchill Tavern in Manhattan, which, by the way, they play his speeches in the bathroom, which just
That's awesome. I have to go there. That's fantastic.
Yes. I shot a little video of it. I've been trying to think of the right time to post it, so I figured I'd wait till after we talk, and you know I wasn't crazy. But I hear his speeches in my head all the time, so it was a little jerk.
Is that me, or is it actually happening?
There's that picture of him with the polka dot tie and his hair slicked back, and you're not used to seeing that. Most people aren't. And when I put it down there at the bar, the bartender said in all earnestness and surprise, "Is that him? He looks like such a little wiener." And I said, "Yeah, I know. He looks like he's wearing his dad's uniform or dressed up for Halloween, but that's this guy who kicks all of this ass and is so, goes 50 years later and does this little thing called saving the world." And I wondered, you as a writer, when you hear today the name Winston Churchill, what flashes in your mind, the sort of turn of the century one or the later one?
Well, now it's the turn of the century one. Before, it was certainly the later one. It was the World War II Winston Churchill, like the great majority of people in the world. But now I think of this young man who was so fresh from childhood. And I think in a lot of those pictures, he looks like he's just playing war. And to some extent, he is. You know, he grew up loving war. You know, he had 1,500 toy soldiers. He's the direct descendant of the first Duke of Marlborough, this incredible general. And it's a huge part of his life. And he loved being at Sandhurst. He loved the war games, but he thought it was a shame that it all had to be pretend. And so as soon as he could, he sort of launched himself into war. And that was very much what the British Empire was like at that time. You know, there are all these colonial wars going on all around the world all the time. And so you could kind of take your pick. And he was constantly looking for the biggest, the most interesting battle anywhere in the country and asking his mother to help him get an assignment so he could go and he could get noticed and he could have these opportunities for gallantry and for advancement.
One of the few real times he spends close with his father is setting up those toy soldiers. His father comes in and says, "I see your light on artillery. I should send you some artillery." And Winston is just
thrilled.
He has such distant Victorian parents. He's just thrilled by that. I mean, it's heartbreaking. You've read the letters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But by this point, his father is dead. So he can't have this dream of going to Parliament with him and fighting side by side. But he is able to finally to have a relationship with his mother. And you focus on her and their letters back and forth. Usually people sort of mention that in passing, that she brings the hospital ship and they say she's beautiful and had a lot of suitors. But you chose to focus on that almost as a subplot, that and Pamela Plowden, his sort of girlfriend. I think he thinks she's more of a girlfriend, right, than she does. Why did you choose to focus on that? What did that say to you about him at this point?
Well, I think these are very important figures in his life at this point, and actually throughout his life, even Pamela Plowden. So this is the first love of his life. She's this beautiful young woman. She's celebrated in London society for her intelligence and her beauty and her charm. And she has a lot of suitors, but Churchill loves her. And it's fascinating to me to read their letters to each other, because he explains to her what we want to know about him. And I remember one letter he writes to her during that first election that he lost before the war. And he says, you know, I don't know what's going to happen during this election. I don't know if I'm going to win or if I'm going to lose. But with every speech I give, I feel my growing powers. And so he had this very clear vision of himself and his future. And it's just all laid out there, you know, in the letter of a young man to this woman he loves. And so that fascinated me. And they, even though, you know, he wanted to marry her, her father wouldn't let them marry because he didn't think that Winston Churchill would amount to anything, which I love.
Yeah,
but
sweet.
They remained friends for the rest of their lives. There are like 65 years of letters between them, and that she kept his letters, and he sort of gallantly burned hers. But thank God we have his letters to her. And then his mother was obviously a much more important figure in his life. You know, he, as so many men did, saw her as this incredibly beautiful and distant figure. You know, he said he loved her and admired her, but at a distance. And he certainly always longed to be close to her when he was a child. And as you say, to read his letters to his parents when he's a child and he's at boarding school begging them to visit him and they don't, it's just really heartbreaking. I find them really difficult to read, especially his father's letters to him, which are often so harsh. But then his father died and he grows up and he's this young man and he's interesting to his mother. And she has all these connections because she has all these admirers, possibly men with which she's had affairs, certainly men whose ear she has and who have power. And he says to her, look, this is a pushing age. We must push with the best. You've got to help me get assignments. And she does again and again and again, helps him get to all these places to fight where he wants to go. And she's a very important figure in his life, which I think it was really disturbing, if not crushing to him, when she tells him as he's about to go to war that she's going to marry this young man whom he knows and who is just 2 weeks older than he is.
Yeah, she still had it. She's 45, I think, at that point.
Yeah, she's 45. And no, she's absolutely beautiful and one of these, you know, incredibly charismatic women, is just, you know, a magnet to men of all ages.
And she just goes ahead and does what she wants, even though everybody else is telling her not to. You'd think that I don't know where he got that from.
mystery, huh? I know. I think that so much of his character that seems so strange and so un-British, it's the American in him. You know, it's the Jenny in him.
So she helps him. She pulls these strings for him, helps get him to South Africa. He's writing for a paper, again, not a combatant, even though he still has the jacket on there, half in uniform. The Boers ambush the Hairy Mary, this train. If folks haven't seen it, they should, maybe they can go to CandiceMillard.com. I bet you have a picture of it there and see what it looks like. It looks very, very intimidating, as Churchill says, but there's really nothing more vulnerable because it's on a track.
Right.
So the Boers ambush it. And even though he's just basically what we'd call an embedded journalist today, or correspondent, he springs into action, no authority whatsoever, but he takes charge.
Right, right.
And this is, if he was a superhero, I said in my introduction, that this would be his origin story. This is, you know, Batman falling down into the cave with the bats. And which I know Theodore Roosevelt, there's been shows and all kinds of things on him being, having a lot of parallels there with tragedy and rising up and going west for adventure into war. So what glimpses here of the World War II leader? You said that was mostly what you pictured when you started writing Hero of the Empire. What do we catch from that dramatic scene?
This is the moment that I think is so striking, because what's even more extraordinary than the fact that this 25-year-old correspondent, one of the few civilians on the train, jumps to attention and neatly takes charge of the defense of this train, is the fact that everyone listens to him, that they take orders from him. You know, I mean, there are many soldiers, legitimate, uniformed members of the military on that train. They have their commander right there, Churchill's friend, Aylmer Halden. And everybody, including Halden, is looking to Churchill to tell them what to do. And he does. And he immediately has a plan and he organizes everything and he succeeds. And every man who makes it out alive credits Winston Churchill's resourcefulness and bravery for saving their lives. And it's just extraordinary. And you think, I could never do that. There's a high probability that I would be cowering behind one of the armored walls of the train as they're under this incredible hailstorm of bullets and shells from these bores. People are dying all around them. People are horribly wounded. At one point, a man's arm is blown off when he's standing right next to Churchill. But he not only is sort of trying to save himself, his instinct is to take charge, not even just to help, but to take charge, to take command. And that's something that you can only be born with. You know, I think that a leader, like any talent, like singing or painting, it can be taught to a very limited degree. I think that to be a great leader, a world-class leader like Winston Churchill was, I think you have to be born with it. And you have to not only have that courage inside of yourself, but you have to be able to radiate it to other people. It has to be contagious. And we see that in that moment as well. So the engine driver, the only person who can move the train, he's hit by a fragment, right, of a shell, and he's ready to make a run for it. He's furious. It's ridiculous. They don't pay me for this. And Churchill stops him. And he makes, to me, it seemed like this kind of miniature St. Crispin's Day speech. You know, look, this isn't some horrible misfortune. On the contrary, this is a rare and an extraordinary opportunity to be incredibly brave and gallant and save the day. And if you climb back in that cab, I will make sure that your sacrifice is acknowledged. And the guy incredibly looks at him and says, okay, and gets back in the cab and does what, and Churchill says, and he followed every order I gave him after that.
Yeah.
And I also love the fact that later on, when Churchill is in a position of power to do it, he makes sure that that guy does get a medal.
And he tells him also in there that he gets hit and he's bloodied. The guy is shot already. And he tells him, well, don't worry. Nobody gets shot twice in the same day. I realize the guy's in shock.
I know. Who believes that? Right.
Yeah. He's speaking to that little bit of him that is still brave inside that man and wants to resist and is looking for any reason to. It's just, like you said, you're born knowing to say it.
Right. And again, that's what we see in World War II, 40 years later, you know, and that's what made such a difference in the war, you know, is that when Winston Churchill tells you, you know, you're not ordinary, you're actually extraordinary like I am, and you're really brave and you're really resourceful and capable and you can do all of these things and you can make a difference. When he tells you that, you believe him and you are capable of things that you never would have dreamed of.
He does end up captured from this. The men are saved. And you have a chapter title in your book, and it translates into always more audacity, I believe.
Right.
And I thought of that there because here he's leading this, and you've been there, stood on the ground. So he's not as if he's 100 miles away, and he's dressed uniquely. And they all see him leading the defense. And so he doesn't want to surrender, but fortunately forgets his gun. He remembers Napoleon, as anybody would, with the two armed boars coming down and you're trying to justify not dying. You think of Napoleon. But the audaciousness that he says, no, I was just a correspondent. And the boars are saying, we saw you. You know, we were there too, watching you do the defense. And he just sticks to that story. And you'd think that he would be relieved, at least. He'd had his moment. You know, a lot of people go to war. They just want to see the elephant, as they used to say, and go home and write about it. And okay, I'm done.
Right.
But he doesn't feel relief when he's captured. He experiences the depression that plagued him his whole life, the black dog, as he called it. Mm-hmm. And there's a picture in Hero of the Empire showing him in that POW camp. And you could just see a lot of photos of him in this period. He looks kind of ticked because he knows he should be running things that he's not, which I love. But I wanted you to get in his head a little bit there as a way of explaining to listeners what's going through his mind in captivity and what do his fellow soldiers think of having him include them in their escape. They're not exactly positive on the whole idea.
So he's furious at himself. You know, what was the point of all of that? What was the result? The result is that now I'm a prisoner of war. I'm missing out on all this potential adventure and opportunities for glory that the war offers. And I'm stuck in this POW camp in Pretoria. And he's just miserable. And you can see it, as you say, so well in that picture. He despises all the Boers there who are watching him. He can't stand the thought that he is their captive. You know, he actually had great respect for the Boers on the battlefield. You know, he acknowledged the fact that they were superior fighters. They were better marksmen. They had great weapons and they knew the terrain so well, and they were beating the British Empire, you know, the mighty British Empire. And so he respected them, but he despised those Boers in Pretoria, where he's now in this prison right there in Pretoria, and frustrated and furious. And he says later in life, you know, he never forgot how it felt to be a prisoner. And he says in later life that he hated this period in his life more than he had ever hated any other time in his entire life. He was absolutely miserable, and he describes it. You talked about his book, My Early Life, and he describes how it felt to be, you know, confined to a narrow space with fences around him and armed guards staring at him. And it just made him absolutely miserable. And from the moment he was captured, he was determined to escape.
It's really a low point, and yet he's still leading. You know, he goes to the guys and they're sort of jostling around, and they feel like I just described, that maybe you and I would feel, well, for us, the war is over, as they would say in World War II. And he says to them, you stop this right now. You have to carry yourselves with dignity. And meanwhile, again, reporter, guy, basically the equivalent today from the AP, or not even as distinguished as the AP. I mean, just one paper. And they listen. And that's the thing again and again.
Right.
The fact that he shows that mercy to the Boers, he uses his influence later in life when he's in the British government to make the lot easier for prisoners, even horrible crimes that they've committed, that they're in solitary life sentence. He says, well, they still have to endure to make sure they have books. And it does influence him so much.
It does. It really does. And I also love the fact that for one moment, as they're bringing him into Pretoria, he sort of feels the weight of it, but then he gets that spark back. And I love the fact, I think it's so Churchillian, that his ideas for escape aren't some, you know, small, quiet little plan to just get out himself. No, it has to be this grand scheme of magnificent audacity where, you know, he's going to free this whole prison, and then he's going to free the prison that holds the soldiers, and then he's going to take over Pretoria, and he's going to kidnap the president, he's going to end the war, you know, and and everybody, all these other officers, most of whom are older and they're much more seasoned, and they're just, you know, go bother somebody else, kid.
And he tells everybody, which is the first step, should we don't blab to the whole place.
but you know, what good is it if people can't admire your idea?
Right, yeah.
Why keep it to yourself?
My guest is Candace Millard, and her new book that we're both enjoying talking about as much as I enjoyed reading it is Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and the Making of Winston Churchill. You can visit her at CandaceMillard.com, one of the coolest author websites I've ever seen. My compliments to your IT people if you didn't design it yourself.
No.
And follow her on Twitter at Candace_Millard. The Kansas City Star praised Hero of the Empire, writing, quote, Millard has no shortage of strengths as a writer, but particularly spectacular is her ability to make history and historic figures not only relatable, but absolutely relevant to contemporary readers. That idea of relatability is one that Churchill cared very much about. He's not a guy that's up on a pedestal. He really cares about young people. He does have hard times in those early schools. He wrote in My Early Life, quote, 20 to 25, these are the years. Don't be content with things as they are. Don't take no for an answer. Never submit to failure, something he very much lives over the course of your book.
Mm-hmm.
Millennials today are much focused on, much maligned, much marketed to. What do you think your Boer War Churchill in Hero of the Empire has to say to young people?
What I take away from it, and I would love for young people to take away from it, is that, look, there are a lot of people who, like Winston Churchill, when they're young especially, think that they're destined for greatness, and they're wondering what is out there for them, but they know inside that they're ready for something bigger and better than themselves. The difference is that Churchill made it happen. He didn't sit around waiting for something to come into his life or for God to reach down and pluck him out of his humdrum days and put him into some extraordinary situation. He went out and found the opportunities. And again, there's a good dose of luck in his life, but luck only comes around when you prepared for it and you seek out those opportunities yourself. And so I think he's this extraordinary example and this unbelievable opportunity to learn from him about making your own luck and finding something in your life that's bigger than yourself through your own actions. It's all about throwing yourself into something and making it into something bigger. And that's what he's just brilliant at.
He had a favorite school song at the Harrow School when he was a young boy called Giants. And don't worry, I won't try to sing it, but he loved it. And when he goes back in World War II, he's sorry to find they no longer sing it. And I don't think he'd been back in between, which tells you he didn't have a great time there. But the first verses of how there were these magnificent giants of old and they threw to 100 yards or more. They were never lame or stiff or sore and basically just awesome how we look at these historic figures like Churchill. Mm-hmm. And then the last line is, I think it's all bull, basically, that we're cast in a pygmy mold and that we can't measure up to them. And it's you and me, whoever we be, measure up to the giants of old, you see. Mm-hmm. And that is something that, as you were talking about him there, that's really what he has there. He wants people to be able to look at him as an example. And he's always kind of winking at you as a historian, I would think, reading.
Yes, absolutely. You know, you do feel it's strange to throw yourself into this time and especially into his writings, what he wrote about, because there's so much of it. You know, not only did he write later about it, but he was writing at the time. You know, he was writing while he was a POW all along this whole experience. He's writing dispatches for the Morning Post, and you hear his voice so clearly and strongly. He has such an original writing style, and he's such a magnificent writer. And so you do feel like he's talking to you, and it's this sort of very knowing story, and you feel like you're a part of it.
Churchill writes at one point that he's riding his pony along the front of a skirmish line at Malacan as an earlier battle. Everyone else is lying down for cover, he says. Foolish, perhaps, but given an audience, there is no act too daring or too noble. Without the gallery, things are different. Now, when he does manage an escape and he ends up, you know, this is also great that the other two guys don't want to bring him, but then he ends up being the only one that escapes and they have their own escape plan later, which ends up going absurdly wrong. They don't get shot, but it's absurd. Mm-hmm. And
miserable.
But he's pretty full of himself there and he's really happy. He walks out, things go pretty well. And then he has the first self-doubts of his life. He wakes up that first morning that he's a fugitive and he really doubts himself. And eventually, you know, he jumps out of the POW camp with nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you sent that to your editor as a novel, they'd probably say, well, you know, nobody could have this much against them. Give him a little something,
right.
You know,
like, right.
Otherwise it's kind of Godzilla versus Bambi and it's not believable when he gets out of it, but
exactly.
He does. And he has his God in a box. Mm-hmm. Talk about that feeling that he has there. Talk about how alone he is and how he deals with that. And again, how that's part of his origin story.
So as you say, so this wasn't even his plan that got him over the fence. So he overheard Aylmer Holden, who was his friend who had invited him on the armored train, and another man named Brocky, who was this very scrappy guy who spoke Zulu, who spoke Afrikaans, who knew the South African felt very well. And he heard them plotting an escape scheme that was very different from the sort of grand one that he had come up with, was simply that at night when the electric lights came on, there was one corner of the fence in the prison yard that remained dark. And if one of the guards happened to have his back turned and you were in the right spot, then you could get over very quickly. And that's all that was to that part of the plan, at least. And Churchill overheard it and he said he wanted to be a part of it. And neither Halton nor Brocky wanted him to come with them. They knew he would blab. He would tell everybody the plan. He was too famous. They knew that they would notice right away if he was gone. And they didn't think he was strong enough to make it almost 300 miles to Portuguese East Africa. And so they told him, Brocky was furious. He said, absolutely not. We're not going to do that. Halton felt a little guilty because he thought, well, he is my friend, and it is kind of my fault that he was on the train to begin with, and that's what led to his capture. And so he said, look, Churchill, we don't want you to come with us. We don't think it's a good idea, and we think that it's going to harm the plan and endanger us, but I'm going to leave the decision up to you. And Churchill, being Churchill, said, okay, I'm coming. He immediately, all right, I'm part of the plan. I don't care if you don't want me to. And so, like you said, they pick their night and they all kind of give it a try, and the guards are really watching and they don't have a chance. And the other two decide they're just going to go on to dinner and try again after dinner. And Churchill sees his opportunity, makes it over the fence. The problem is that the other two can't. He waits for an hour in these bushes at great, great peril to his own life, waiting for them to come. And not only because it was their plan and they're his friends, but also because they have everything. They have the map, the compass, the food, the weapon. He doesn't speak the language. He doesn't know the rest of the plan. He has nothing. You know, he has some chocolate in his pocket.
And his hat.
And his hat, right. But he has, and they can't. They can't go, and he can't get back in. And finally, he just says, okay, I shall go alone. And he thinks, I'm definitely going to be captured right away. So what do I have to lose? And so he sort of saunters through Pretoria, and the farther he goes, the more exhilarated he feels. You know, he thinks this is working. And he also is just so thrilled to be out of captivity, even if it's for a short time, even if he's recaptured. He loves the night air, feels fantastic. He just is reveling in his freedom, but he has a long way to go. And again, he has no help. And his hope waxes and wanes, and he definitely goes through moments of crisis. And that's when I think we can see his character really clearly. And that's when we can relate to him as a human being. You know, I think often we put him on this pedestal and think that he's almost a different species than we are. But when he's young and he's scared and he's vulnerable and he's on the South African veld by himself, he at one point breaks down, and he, not being a religious man at all, he prays to God for guidance. Those feelings of terror and despair, we can all relate to.
Talking about James Garfield for Destiny of the Republic, you said that his phrase, the bed of the sea, sticks with you, that that you see someone's true character when they're desperate. Having made good that escape, and in that moment, literally everything's against him. He's exhausted. He almost wishes that they would come and capture him again because he just cannot go on. Mm-hmm. Exhausted, hungry, alone, needing really anything, somewhere to sleep, a corner of anywhere. He has that inspiration, and it happens twice in just this origin story alone. Mm-hmm. And he heads for what he sees, lights and fires in the distance. And I don't even know what the odds here would be for this. I guess Spock would calculate them, but they've moved out all the British because the Boers are at war with them, and they take this very business-like approach to killing people and to war. And so they've moved them all out except for a few key ones. Churchill knocks on a door, and it's the only English house in 110,000 square miles. The only one. So even though we know it's true, that's so shocking.
It is. I mean, as you say, what are the odds? And that's when you know, I mean, as determined as he was and how brave as he was and the sort of ingenuity and this agility that had gotten him that far, there's also a very healthy dose of luck. And this is where you see it most clearly. So he sees in the distance what he thinks are fires, a part of an African village. And he knows, he's like, hey, the Africans hate the Boers even more than we do. And so maybe they'll help me. Maybe I can convince them to maybe give me a pony and a guide. But as he gets closer, he realizes it's not a village, it's a colliery. And he just feels so desperate at that point and feels like he has nowhere else to turn that he takes this just extraordinary chance. And he steps out of the gloom and he knocks on this door. And I also love the fact that so this man, John Howard, opens the door and Churchill just, you know, creates this whole lie out of whole cloth. He just spins it. And as he's spinning it, he's kind of marveling at himself, like, wow, where did this come from? Yeah. And he says, oh, you know, I'm a boar and I fell off the train and I hurt my shoulder and I need help. And he's realizing also, like, you know, this is not going to work. I don't speak Afrikaans or Dutch. I can't pull this off. And the guy just looks at him and says, I think you should come inside. He follows him inside. He takes him to this room and he puts a gun. This man, John Howard, puts a gun on the table between them. And Churchill says, I think I better tell you the truth. And Howard says, yeah, I think you should. And he says, look, I'm Winston Churchill. I've escaped from prison. I have some money. And he's like, can you help me? And the man just looks at him and turns around and locks the door. And Churchill's thinking, this is not looking good for me. It's really
he
not.
He is wanted dead or alive.
Yeah, he was. The Boers, right. The Boers are enraged. They're humiliated. They're looking everywhere for him. And if they find him, there's a very real risk that they'll kill him. And here's this man with this gun, and he thinks, he's going to turn me in or he's going to kill me himself. And instead, he thrusts out his hand and he shakes Churchill's hand. And he says, I'm British and I'm going to help you. And Churchill says he felt like a drowning man who had been pulled from the water. But it is this, he took this audacious risk, but the only reason it worked was because he was extraordinarily lucky.
Also, speaking of his dead or alive on the poster, he uses that later. Michael Collins is complaining to him about the British putting a bounty on his head when Ireland has the uprisings. And he takes it off his wall and shows him the wanted poster. And he says, hey, they only wanted 25 pounds from me. At least we're asking, I think it's 10,000 or something from Michael Collins. And so,
right. That always rubbed him wrong.
I always picture him when he gets that sign and sees only 25 pounds. I don't know if you watched Bugs Bunny when you were growing up, but when Bugs Bunny sees the bounty on rabbits is only 2 cents and he goes nuts. He says, oh, come on, a rabbit's as valuable as some stupid moldy elk. Come on. And so that's, who thinks that? You have so many of those moments when you're reading Hero of the Empire.
That's hilarious. Yeah, he was very insulted by that 25 pound reward, but the Boers weren't playing. They were serious. They wanted to find him, and it's a very, very dangerous situation for him. And he knew that he was putting John Howard and the men who were at the Collier and were going to help him in a very dangerous situation as well, because the Boers had allowed them to not take part in the war because of the fact that they were British citizens. But if they had been seen to be harboring an enemy of the Boers and helping him, they were in great danger.
And I want people to know as they read it, it's all completely factual. James A. Garfield, to mention him again, he said once that every book should be required to have an index. And you certainly do have an index. Everything is footnoted. And you have said it's important to you that everybody know everything's absolutely factual. So how do you organize all that? I've seen, again, if people go to CandiceMillard.com, they'll see your Star Trek-y setup there, three screens and all the books. But how do you do that when you read so much? How do you have recall of what you might want to go back and use?
Over time, and I never kind of sat down and set up a system, but over time, since this is my third book, I've been doing this for 15 years, and each book is sort of the foundation of it is an extreme amount of research and a huge quantity of primary source material. So first of all, I won't commit to a book idea unless I know I have not just a lot, but too much primary source material. There's always a point in my research where I think, oh my God, I'll never get through it all, but you have to feel like that for it to work. You have to be drowning in letters and journals and diaries and newspaper accounts, or you can't have dialogue. You can't have all these details that you hope will bring the story alive. And so what I do is I spend the first year and a half just gathering everything I can, reading everything I can. And as I read, I just mark it up. I highlight, I underline, I annotate. If I see something that's good, I'll put a star. If I see something that's really good, I'm definitely going to use it. It's two stars. If it's something like unbelievable, I can't, this is such a great fact or such a great quote, it gets three stars. And so when I go back, then I start to organize things, and I organize them thematically, largely. So there's a section on Churchill, but not just Churchill, but his personality and his childhood and his relationship with his mother, his relationship with Pamela, and all of these are kind of intersecting too. And it makes it easier because I think, oh, I know I read something about that. Where was that in one of my files? Is it in one of my books? Where is it? I can find it more quickly when I finally get to the point where I want to write. So I would say 80% of the time that I spend on a book is doing research and organizing it and understanding it and then putting it in an outline. And so years go by before I even think about writing.
It makes you envy Lord Randolph Churchill and Winston himself. Lord Randolph was the one who really had the photographic memory. He could have really helped you with all of that, it occurs to me. But
that would come in handy. I do not have one of those.
Your first book, River of Doubt, traces Theodore Roosevelt's perilous trip on an unmapped Amazon tributary. I always found it a fascinating parallel that critics doubted his account of the trip down the Amazon or down the River of Doubt, just as they doubted Churchill's account of things. And for instance, TR, I think it's the, you know, a big British society, their equivalent of the Audubon Society. And they doubt that he did it. And he says, what do you think? I took the subway from the mouth of the river to the end. And that's why I lost all this weight. And, you know, and Churchill, the same thing. And one of the things with him is the eyes of those rats in the coal mine. There were these white rats. They're albinos, actually, with the pink eyes. And people just scoff. Well, that, come on, he's making it up. And then they go you know, way later and they find their descendants there living in the coal mine still.
And thriving. Perfect environment for them.
Churchill and TR share that. They really are like comic book characters. I mean, you get some people that say, well, this book reads like, not your book, but books on them. It's just unreal what they do. They're like the giants of old story, but they really did do them. And so it's amazing to me. What is it that draws you as a writer to figures like these and Garfield? Granted, Garfield, you met through looking into Alexander Graham Bell. So you kind of had the first bite at the apple, so to speak, for most readers. But is it a challenge to keep them so relatable, or do you find they help you out with things like Churchill's self-deprecation?
Well, I think that what I'm looking for, what I'm interested in, are these moments where they are so relatable, they're so human, and you find those moments not in those sort of big, broad events that are public, they're moments of triumph or infamy that we usually think of when we look back in time, but these more private moments of struggle, you know, where there's personal doubt and there's despair or sorrow or grief, or as you're saying with Garfield, sickness, and they're sort of laid bare and you really see their character. And I think that is what makes them relatable. That's where you can say, well, this person is really human. It's not this mythical figure that he seems in his setting in history, but he's a human being like I am. And I would have the same emotions and fears and hopes had I been put in that same situation. And I think that's where we can see ourselves in them. And that's another reason I love doing my own research. It's really enjoyable. And, you know, you never know what you're going to find. But you have these constant reminders of the humanity of your subject. And I think that's really important to keep in mind when you're writing about them.
Alice Roosevelt Longworth, TR's daughter, his oldest child, was once asked why her father didn't like Churchill. And if you were like me, when you first saw that footnote or first, however you saw the description of their first meeting and that TR didn't like him, thought he slouched, he smoked inside, didn't get up when women entered the room, these little slights that TR was conscious of. Having written books on both, I wondered if you find that as frustrating as I do. And I'd written that question and said, you know, TR takes a while. He eventually, when Churchill's in charge of the Royal Navy during the Great War, he reluctantly writes and says, I'm seeing him doing these things and please tell him that he has my congratulations for what he's doing with the fleet. And you're kind of like, finally, he's seeing what we all see in Churchill. That was my scripted question, but then I was reading the book and I read Pamela Plowden's line that you include. The first time you meet Winston, you see all his faults, and the rest of your life you spend in discovering his virtues. Do you have feelings about that, that the two of them didn't get along, that maybe because TR dodged him for one thing when he went to London, avoided meeting him, that they didn't have a chance to have what seems to us on the outside to be such a relationship with things in common?
Well, I think that part of the problem is that they were too much alike. Certainly Roosevelt must have seen in Churchill his younger self, you know. They're both known not only for their brilliance and their voracious reading and their, you know, magnificent writing, but for their arrogance and their ambition. And I think that it's really, really hard to turn off. I think that's what's interesting about people who are highly, highly ambitious when they're very young, as Churchill and Roosevelt were, is that you can't then turn it off. When you don't kind of mellow with age, when it's as heightened as it was for them in their youth, it doesn't taper off. They just can't turn it off. And so they are just as ambitious and continue to push throughout their lives. You know, Churchill lived to be 90 years old, as you know, and was a towering figure to the end. And Roosevelt only lived to be 60 years old, but he was fighting with Wilson, Woodrow Wilson, and he was furious with Wilson for not letting him fight in World War One when he was 55 years old. So,
and half blind. And right. Roosevelt said to him, one of his aides, what is wrong with him? You know, the president, doesn't he realize I'm only being asked for the chance to go and die? And the man says to him, well, did you make that perfectly clear to Wilson?
That's right.
Then he probably would have sent you.
That's right. You might have let you go.
Yeah.
That would have been appealing. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But I think that when you have a character like that, you know, we walk in the room, you absolutely take over. I just don't think there's enough room in the world for these two towering figures. And I think it's really difficult for them to like each other.
Well, Alice was right again, so she would have liked that, right?
Yes, yeah,
they were very much alike. It's tantalizing to think of what might have been. I guess that's the historian's job to speculate on that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you've been very generous with your time. So final question, and that is, you spend 3 or 4 years here, the first year researching, as you were saying, and I know you usually miss deadlines. You're frank about it. You just you don't always meet them. And I wonder if you've met any other historical figures. How do you get that next idea? It needs to be somebody that you want to spend those 3 or 4 years with.
Right.
So
that's exactly right.
Do you take time off after you finish promoting, or how do you start looking forward to the next idea?
Well, you know, I think like anybody, as you're going along and you're reading things, but both doing research and doing just personal reading, you come across little ideas that pique your interest and you think maybe this has some potential and you tuck them away. And I certainly have drawers full of files, full of ideas that will never see the light of day. But I do have three intriguing to me, at least, possibilities, three things that I think I might like to write about, you know, and I might be willing to spend years of my life thinking about, but I haven't had a chance to do enough research to know if it's going to work. And more importantly, as we've discussed again and again, if there's enough primary source material there. So I'm actually really looking forward to that. I'm going to be traveling through the end of November for this book. And then I can already see December sort of glittering in the distance where I get to, you know, be back with my family. And if the kids are in school, go back to my office and close the door and just read and read and read and read. And that's when I always feel incredibly fortunate to be able to do this job. And that's when I feel just unbelievably self-indulgent. And I just get to read and sort of figure it out. And really looking forward to that.
Well, Candace Millard, we are fortunate to have you writing for us. As Churchill said to FDR, it's fun to be in the same century as you. So I'm glad you're here writing.
Right back at you. Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Again, the book is Hero of the Empire: The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase your copy at historyauthor.com. Once again, my sincere thanks to Candace Millard for joining us. Whether you're familiar with the young Churchill or you're meeting him for the first time, I bet you'll enjoy Hero of the Empire as much as I did. You can find this week's guest at candacemillard.com or at the handle Candace_Millard on Twitter. And while you're at it, let us know what you think of the book and the interview on Twitter at HistoryDean or Facebook.com/HistoryAuthor. If you're fascinated by Churchill, I'd like to recommend another author we had on the show, Jonathan Sands, Churchill's great-grandson and the host of Churchill Chat. Jonathan's book is God and Churchill: How the Great Leader's Sense of Divine Destiny Changed His Troubled World and Offers Hope for Ours. You could find that interview and the one with Simon Reed about his book, Winston Churchill Reporting, in our archives, wherever you're listening, or at historyauthor.com. Well, that's it for this installment of the History Author Show. I hope you'll join us for next Monday's all-new interview right here on iHeartRadio. And if you subscribe to us on iTunes, please take a minute to leave us a review. Until our next trip into the past together, thanks so much for time traveling with us today, and have a great week.
We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.